I'm going to start reading in verse 13, chapter 2 of 1 Samuel. The priest's custom of the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant came while the flesh was in seething and with a flesh hook of three teeth in his hand, a sort of a trident, I guess. He stuck it into the pan or kettle and brought up the meat that the priest took for himself. Interesting point, the Levites got their living really from the residuals of the offerings. They got their food from that. They burnt the fat. The priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, "Give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee, but raw. And if any man said unto him, let him not fail to burn the fat presently, then take as much as thy soul desireth. Then he would answer him, nay, but thou shalt give it me now. If not, I will take it by force." So the sons of Eli, were being boorish and overbearing in their sharing of this sacrifice. That's the scenario, is that these sons apparently were being obnoxious in their handling of that thing. So it says, "Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord." In other words, their conduct in the sacrificial situation was such that people were offended and abhorred the sacrifice. It would be very much like someone in the clergy today, in a ministry whose commercial tactics might cause people to dislike the church or something like that. But it was deeper than that, of course, because now the sacrifice was the essence of the worship of the Jews. So it was a more important kind of a thing, perhaps, even than what we would regard as the ministry today. But Samuel ministered before the Lord, being a child, girded with a linen ephod. His mother made him a little coat. Incidentally, Hannah, according to the text here, had three sons and two daughters, so the Lord really rewarded her with the children that she wanted. Eli now was very old and feared all that his sons did unto all Israel. Apparently, that was only the tip of the iceberg. In other words, a lot of things that these young men were doing and taking advantage of their position, like brattish preacher's kids. You know, sometimes preacher's kids can be very brattish people that run about and offend the general congregation, all present company excepted, of course. It took me 20 years to get over what I learned as a child in my church before I could start really ministering. Anyway, I was not really all that great as a child in the church. So Eli heard all the sons that his sons did and how they, in fact, they had gone on and really taken advantage of women in the congregation and so forth. And they really were very odious young men. And he said, "Why do you do these things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all his people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. If a man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat him? Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them." That's not uncommon, that young people would not hearken to the voice of their fathers. That's not been a rare thing. So anyway, they were acting very poorly. I would like to just make a comment here in regard to this matter, because it has very strong bearing on the way we handle our children. We had here a situation where the sacrificial offerings were a very sacred trust, and it was up to Eli to instruct his sons in this matter, and he apparently didn't do a very good job of it. And that was what the crux of the matter was. He had failed to teach them the way of the Lord. In their case, it made a great deal of difference because it had to do with a very sacred sacrificial system. But throughout the centuries, the only successful way to raise children is to... let me rephrase that, because I don't know that success is all that easily pinpointed. But at least parents ought to set a good example before the children of honest faith. Of course, it does no good if the parents have a double standard, you know, for themselves and their children. And that itself is not uncommon. Parents also often will have a double standard in which they say, well, I realize that it's hurt me to do this, but I don't want my own children to do it. So you have to watch the matter of example. And apparently, whatever Eli's relation to his sons was, he had not been a very good example. Later on, God is going to slay them because they offered false fire. In other words, we'll come to that chapter later. But they, after Eli died, they assumed the position of making an offering. And they were slain by God for it, because he just simply does not trifle with these things of the Spirit. God has his, I'm sure, his parameters of what constitutes defiance of the Spirit or dishonoring of the Spirit of God. But we have to be very careful, not that we're going to be slain, but rather we distinguish between what is of the Spirit and what is of the flesh in our own activity. As I was saying this morning, we have to be conscious, sensitive of the fact that the essence of the nature of our lives is Spirit. That's what it's all about. If we function in the context of the flesh, then we miss the whole point of our existence. And the only thing that keeps us going in the midst of great inequities in the world, and sorrows often, and pains and so forth, the thing that keeps us going is that we are spirit beings. It doesn't really make any difference in that respect what goes on in the world. As the psalmist says, "Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of?" In other words, if people wrong you and you are harassed by people who might be even doing Satan's work, in other words, if you're being harassed in a particular way, as I've said to you before, in an occupied city, the people that really get along the best are the people that cooperate with the enemy, you know. And people who are more or less moving down a purely secular road, where their whole lives are basically directed toward making a good life here in the world, people in that position are no problem to Satan. He would encourage them. But where we are really representing Christ, Satan would like to discourage us. Now, not everything that is negative that comes to us is necessarily of Satan. A lot of it is just human inadequacy, human failure and flaws and so forth. But there are things that Satan himself attacks. He levels upon us in different ways, physical or material or whatever. And sometimes a Christian may wonder why everybody around them is prospering and they're not. But maybe at some point Satan is trying to throw a monkey wrench in the situation. The way to really handle this is to recognize that A, we are spirit beings, after all. That is our main focus. And B, Satan cannot do anything against our spirit. He can cause us a lot of hassling in the flesh, but he can't do our spirit in, you see, if you understand what I mean. And C, that the entire offering of Satan is transient, disintegrative, so that it's not that big a bargain, after all. And people have often sort of set aside spiritual pursuit in order to take up something that seems to be more important for their career. For example, people might be coming to a Bible study group and getting fed every week and so forth. Then they take a job, or they get moved up into something where they're not able any longer to attend. Now, obviously, given my view of things, if they were going somewhere else on another night or whatever, I'd be fine. I would understand that, and it wouldn't be any problem. But where they have set aside spiritual values in order for earthly advantages. You see, they've missed the main function, a priority that God has for us, and that is that we are spirit beings and not flesh beings primarily, and whatever happens in the flesh is totally secondary. So the fundamental approach to things is that we, if we see ourselves in a spiritual relationship to Christ, and we see all of these things around us that are negative and a problem and so forth, we can remember that we do belong to Christ and that we are His, and that opportunism in this world is not only brings unfortunate consequences but also is foolish, because this world simply has not anything to really offer us as far as our spirits are concerned. Well, Eli's sons have gone off in a wrong direction, and they have gone off in such a direction as to now invoke the disfavor of God, and that is serious. Some things we do are just merely going to bring fleshly consequences. But if we offend the Lord, now, not in terms of saying, well, today I did this little thing or that little thing, but one thing he does make rather clear, Jesus makes clear, if we offend one of his little ones, if any man offend one of his little ones, it were better that a millstone be hanged about his neck, he'd be drowned in the sea. Now, what I see in that is not just a literal thing that a person who causes difficulty to little children is in jeopardy, but children in terms of the fact that we're all God's children. And if we offend the Lord's children, once again, not in terms of maybe giving them a little trouble, but I mean in terms of affecting their faith and their life. People are, for example, so quick to give advice. But if the advice is not coming from the Spirit of the Lord, it can be harmful. One quick word of advice to someone can cause a lot of distress and, in a sense, offend one of the Lord's little ones. Now, literally, I don't think the Lord wants that person to go take their life and jump off the bridge with the cement tennis shoes on. I think that he's really advancing a word of caution. Don't hurt my children. This is what, of course, Phineas and Hophni, with their phony facade, you know, with their phony approach to the priesthood, were hurting the Lord's people, and they got judged for that. I don't know how the Lord plans to judge, or whether, or whatever judgment there might be for those who, in their leadership, have misled people, and I'm talking, of course, most importantly about the sects, such as the Hare Krishna or the Moonies or someone, who have done a great disservice to the people, or the Scientology people and so forth. And whereas now it doesn't look like anything is going to be go wrong there, that, in other words, that they seem to prosper in their enterprises, although they've all had some kind of trouble from time to time. But we look at that and say, why does the Lord leave them there? Why doesn't he wipe them out? Well, that's a question I really can't answer. But I will say that we do have to leave it in the Lord's hands. He knows what he's doing down the line, and we certainly don't. I wouldn't press the point to say anyone who's out of order is going to get slain. That would be too extreme. But I would say that we have to be careful how we deal with one another, because if we are all children of God and we make an attack upon someone else, of our brothers or sisters, we need to watch out. And that's why I say ministers who mislead the people need to really watch out. Watch what they're doing. It's even more critical than a medical doctor. If a medical doctor makes a misevaluation of the situation and either over-medicates or under-medicates or whatever, or causes physical damage, it is, after all, only physical. Not that it's unimportant, but it is physical. But one who is involved in the souls of people, it's a different thing. The eternal soul of that individual can be affected by careless counseling or careless handling of the word, on the part of a minister. So he just he has to know what he's doing. You've got to have the sense that this is what the Lord wants him to do, or otherwise he might hurt the Lord's people. So Phinehas and Hophni were of the category of really ravaging the Lord's people, taking advantage of the women and taking advantage of the food situation. And it was a stench in the nostrils of God, if we may say so. So Eli has confronted his sons with it, but it is too late. He's not going to be able to help them, and they will ultimately die as he will. So then it goes on, the child Samuel grew and was in favor both with the Lord and also with men. The person who walks in life in love and care and understanding, sensitivity to Christ, to the general people one deals with, there will be an affinity, an appreciation. Wherever you go, in the office or wherever, people will, generally speaking, be drawn to you. If you're reflecting something of the Spirit of Christ. Now, the point about it is this. If you have someone who is antagonistic to God, however, you have someone who is at least a self-styled atheist, that person might cause you trouble because they are opposing God and trying to get at him through you. So it isn't true that everyone, that if you will really be a gracious person, that you'll reflect the Spirit of Christ, that everyone will like you. It's only true that, generally speaking, you will have favor with God and men. And that's what it says of Samuel. He had favor with God and men. It also said it of Jesus. He grew in stature, had favor with God and men. One of those things is treating people right, treating them graciously. For example, if you go into a restaurant, the waiters and waitresses and busboys are their persons. Whether they have a job that may be in the eyes of many a menial task is beside the point. They are as much of value as you are. And I would call them the little people, not because I am putting them down, but because as compared to the management teams and so forth, you treat them properly. And they respond to that. In the spiritual sense, I'm just saying this matter of having favor with God and man is not unimportant. And you don't have to be a compromiser to do that. You don't have to be phony to do it, be falsely gracious. Just be gracious to people. As a child of God, it's a good thing because you never know when you might really touch the strings there of the heart and the need, and they can receive help from you for that. It ought not to be for cause, though. It ought to be just as having the Spirit of Christ. Now, many Christians, unfortunately, have been taught to be ungracious and rude. They learn that the gospel is so important, it doesn't matter whose toes you step on, you got to get the gospel to them. In other words, if you want to collar somebody and give them the word, you can make yourself very obnoxious, and they're not going to listen to you anyway. If you have the feeling that everybody you see, you got to give them a tract, or you got to witness to them. And a lot of people on the job, a lot of Christian people on the job, make a nuisance of themselves, and nobody wants to see them come around. So Christian people can be careless about it, maybe even with an honest motive not to compromise or be a respecter of persons. But that isn't really being a respecter of persons. A Christian person can be obnoxious, and the reason the people don't like them is not because they're Christians, but because they're obnoxious Christians. So the idea of growing and having favor with God and man is valid, and it's wrong to say that if you have favor with non-Christians, it automatically means you're in league with the devil. There are a lot of people that believe that. But you don't have a channel through which to communicate with them if you're not gracious to them. So the Bible, Paul encourages that. He says, be kind toward others, kindly affectioned. He's always urging the Christian to be gracious. There are people in the leadership, on the other hand, but that's a different different matter. If you have people that are opportunists or people that are dishonoring the word of Christ, people that are giving false counsel, for example, many kinds of people who are in service to the Lord are really hurting the people by doing an inadequate job of it. Again, I've indicated that it's all right to sacrifice yourself in behalf of service to others, but don't sacrifice others in behalf of your own service. Don't ride roughshod over people. For example, young people with their families, they become Christians, and they start hassling a family and trying to convert them. And that's happened fairly commonly in some circles. Some of the young people become Christians, and then they go home. And that hasn't happened in our own ministry, because we have a different approach than that, but they've been saved in other circles, and they go home and they hassle mom and dad, make themselves obnoxious, and lose them. It's unfortunate. I ran into this all the time. I ran into it in high school a lot. Young people would come to me, and you know, because their parents had been opposed to their Christianity. I think, generally speaking, if a young person became a Christian and behaved better, they'd go home and be cooperative and so forth. I think the parents might be glad of that, if the Christianity did them some good. But when they go home and they're more ornery than ever, because they think they're now the saviors of the world and their parents are sinners and that they're going to have to convert them and so forth, and they cause more problems. And for that reason, a lot of parents have questioned the connections of their young people, because the young people themselves have come through in an ungracious manner. So it won't hurt us to be gracious and to grow in favor with God and man. Now, you will not eliminate the important opportunities to minister. Now, for example, in one of the hotels that I go to regularly, the desk people are very good. All of them, the desk people are always very gracious and very helpful and cooperative. All right, so last Friday, a young man who was on the desk said to me, "Oh, I hear that you're doing some writing." He said, "Why don't you bring us some of your work?" Well, of course, obviously, I'm going to bring some of my work, but they asked for it. But you see, if I'd been ungracious to them, they wouldn't have ever cared, wouldn't have ever asked. And that's happened over and over again, everywhere. These people are really open, and sometimes we can be a very important help to them. And it says, "There came a man of God unto Eli," this is now in 1 Samuel 2, still verse 27, "and said, Thus saith the Lord, did I plainly appear unto the house of thy father when they were in Egypt in Pharaoh's house, and did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest," etc., etc. He says, "Wherefore kick ye at my sacrifice and mine offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honorest thy sons above me, to make yourself fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people." In a sense, he was saying to Eli, because you haven't dealt with your sons properly about this matter, you've allowed them to offend me and the people without doing anything about it. That, he says, is going to require some judgment. And so he goes on to speak of the judgments that were coming upon him, in which even Phinehas and Hophni were to die, and he was to be cut off from the altar, etc., etc. On the one hand, Samuel was there in the name of Christ in the temple, learning and growing in stature, and these sons of Eli, who were supposed to be in line for the priesthood, were dishonoring that very priesthood. Now comes Samuel, and we're in chapter 3, who was ministering to the Lord. It came to pass that Eli was laid down in his place, and his eyes began to wax dim, etc., etc. And the Eli is now fading out. And so then we have that remarkable incident of God coming to Samuel in the night, in a vision or whatever, to speak to him. And it's an interesting story here. The boy Samuel had laid down at night, and the Lord called Samuel. And Samuel just heard his name, apparently. And so he thought Eli had called him. And he ran quickly to Eli to say, "You called me, did you? What is it that you wanted?" And Eli said, "I didn't call you. Go back, go to sleep." And he did that several times, and so finally Eli finally got with it. And he said, wait a minute, maybe the Lord's talking to this kid. So he said, that when Samuel had come maybe the third time, he said to Samuel, "Well, go lie down, and if you hear a call again, just say, 'Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.'" So Samuel did lie down and wait, and when he heard the name called, he said, "Speak, for thy servant heareth." And so here's the message to Samuel. The Lord said to him, "Behold, I will do a thing in Israel, at which both the ears of everyone that heareth shall tingle. And that day I will perform against Eli." And so he goes down the line of what he's going to do to Eli's house. So he said, "And therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be purged with sacrifice or offering forever." He said, "There's no sacrifice he can offer anymore that's adequate. He's offended me too deeply." So Samuel went and told Eli what the Lord had said. And Eli finally came to his senses and said, "Well, it's the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." It says, "Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord." Now, when it says he didn't let his words fall to the ground, it means that they were listened to, they were heeded. Now, there's the point here, and we'll conclude with this, is that when the Lord speaks through his prophet in a genuine way, the people listen. The test of whether or not someone is coming from Christ is basically what happens to the spirit when they speak with you. In other words, remember when Mary, in the days of her pregnancy, approached Elizabeth, her cousin, Elizabeth also being with child, and she having John in her womb. John in her womb was stirred just by the coming of Mary into the room. And that's what Elizabeth said. The babe kicked, you know, and he now, obviously, this kicking is a common thing, but it was apparently some uncommon episode. But the baby leaped in her womb, she says, maybe far more than the normal process of infantile activity in the womb. But something touched her. Now, the prophet of God was someone that, whether people really agreed with it or liked his message or not, nevertheless, they heard it. It came through. And those that really wanted the truth, it came through to them with the Spirit, with power. There is a lot of ministry that is just ministry. I suppose it wouldn't be too amiss to give an analogy of, and an earthly one, very earthly, of a symphony concert that I went to. And the music was expert. I mean, it's good music. I don't know if I should mention the composers or not. Some things that, say, Bruckner has done are pretty prosaic. You know, they're just music. It just flows along, and it's nice music, but it doesn't have any kick in it, any fire in it. I felt that probably the conductor got more out of it than Bruckner put in it himself. But it was sort of sterile. I mean, it's just nice music, but it had no kick in it. You take someone like Wagner or Dvorak or Mussorgsky or some of these people, even though I'm not saying they're Christian people, but there's fire in their music. You know, there's an impact. It makes an impact on you. But a lot of music is lackluster. Same thing is true in the ministry. The word comes with impact if the Spirit's behind it. And there's an awful lot of ministry out there, just words. And they're interesting and have their place, perhaps, but there's no punch to it. There's no dynamic to it. Well, here was Samuel. When he spoke to people, listened. They didn't have to wonder. I wonder if this is a prophet or not. They knew. The man of God is speaking in the Spirit. People will know. In one way or another, it isn't to say that everything that person says is gospel, you know, is right, is sound. Hopefully it is, but there's no guarantee that there won't be human things creeping in. But in the main, people ought to have that sense that the Spirit is coming through. And I've often said, even in my own ministry, it has to come under the same test. And if people would not find my ministry meeting their needs or touching their hearts, then they ought to go somewhere else. I wouldn't be willing to have them put that test out, because I think the man of God people ought to sense in the message that this is a man of God, not just somebody giving off a lot of words. Well, there's a dynamic here. When the Spirit of Christ touches someone to minister, they'll be effective. There are a lot of people out there ministering or just simply doing a job that they, you know, a person can go into the ministry feeling that's a nice profession and not have the fire that they need or the dynamic, I suppose is the word, to what they're saying. Well, Samuel was touched of God, and wherever he went, the people sensed that here is a man of God, and they listened to him. Well, I think we better stop now. We've gone over the tense prayer. Father, we ask you to bless now this fellowship for the word tonight, and to bless it to our hearts, and give us instruction from it, and also the matters that we discuss now in our private needs. In Christ's name, amen.